This is Brandon's podcast number 56, and today we're talking about simulating flapping wings. So I think we'll have two podcasts out of this paper because it is quite big. I've noticed that in the last podcast we've been going quite a lot. But this podcast will be about the flow physics of flapping wings, and then the second podcast, second part, will be about simulating them. And to do that, we're going to be looking at this paper called Quasi-Steady versus Navier-Stokes Solutions of Flapping Wing Aerodynamics. Now, flapping wings, I have talked about in a few other podcasts, but they are incredibly important because, first of all, they're really complex, so that's really cool from an aerodynamics point of view. But also, flapping wings in general, the type of lift that they produce, or the types of lift that they produce, result in them being very efficient flyers, like insects and birds fly incredibly efficiently. And they're even more efficient than we understand, because every few years we make new breakthroughs in terms of our understanding of how they fly, and we realize, oh wait, they actually fly much better than what we thought to begin with, and they're not worse than our aircraft, which initially people thought, which didn't make sense, because like, how can millions of years of evolution be worse than something that we came up with in a few years? But yeah, so we're figuring out that flapping wing and a bunch of other styles of flapping are better than what we can do. So in this paper, let's look at what they did in terms of investigating flapping wing flight and simulating it. First of all, micro air vehicles, typically 15 centimeters or less in size, will likely be used in a host of applications in the coming years, for military uses to agricultural, industrial functions, and even recreational pursuits. So the small size of MAVs can result in many beneficial qualities, such as high maneuverability, low operating costs, as well as being inconspicuous. So all the peeping Toms out there, they'll be happy. So the design of MAVs is also hampered by the complex aerodynamics of flapping wing flight, which are quite different from aerodynamics that govern larger manned vehicles. In particular, they operate under a Reynolds number that is in orders of magnitude smaller. So for large human-occupied vehicles, the Reynolds numbers are in the orders of millions, tens of millions, and even higher. For MAVs, or let's say for UAVs first, then they become in the hundreds of thousands and maybe the millions. For MAVs, they're even lower. They're like in the hundreds, thousands, and maybe tens of thousands for the Reynolds number. So they're far lower. And the reason why this is important is because at lower Reynolds numbers, the viscosity effects dominate the flow physics, and that changes the flow physics. So at higher Reynolds number, for example, a vortex that is being produced will propagate downstream quite a lot. At low Reynolds numbers, the vortex will die out much quicker because the viscosity is really just pulling it apart. I shouldn't say that. It's resisting its motion, but yeah, it looks like it's being pulled apart when you look at it in a flow vis sort of situation. So they say operating this regime reduces new challenges associated with the aerodynamic efficiency and lift generation, while their small size of MAVs makes them particularly susceptible to environmental factors leading to challenges associated with stability and control. So let's talk about this here. This is a very important fact that most aerodynamicists that look into this don't realize until they start designing their MAVs and their UAVs and even slightly larger aircraft. To illustrate this, I just want to give you a quick example. Quite a few years ago, I was talking with this company they wanted to make flying cars effectively. So they wanted to, you know, everyone for years have wanted flying cars. They wanted to make some of them. And they had funding and they were going along for a couple of years. And then they realized that once they did their sizing and they did some test flights, that it was in their vehicle, which wasn't anything, it wasn't bad. It was good design. It was just incredibly susceptible to gusts and just changes in the oncoming free stream. The reason why is because it was so small. So if you want to make a flying car, for example, it's only going to take a couple of people, maybe four people at most, to be practical. It's going to be very small. It might have a wingspan. I think this one was of 3 or 4 meters. So it was easy to get around the city. But being so small means that you're very susceptible to gusts, because when you think about it, a gust is a localized change in the flow conditions. And if you have a small aircraft, that localized change is going to effectively engulf the entire aircraft or a good portion of it. And so it's going to be more effective than if you have a much larger aircraft. So what they ended up having to do was make the aircraft even bigger. Now, I haven't talked to them for a little while or kept up with what they're doing, but I think, well, they were going to go to taxis last time I talked to them. I don't know how far along they've gone with that. But they were going to size it to be like now 50-foot wingspan, so 15-meter wingspan instead of the 3 or 4 wingspan that they meter wingspan that they had. So that's the detrimental effects that these environmental factors have. And when you go to MAV, it's even worse because MAVs are tiny. And when you look at insects, they get blown around all the time. And that's because they're just so small and they don't weigh very much that their inertia is small, first of all. And secondly, when a little gust comes along, they're completely engulfed by it. So the flow physics that they're seeing changes and they need to manipulate their wings and their tails and whatever they have to cope with it. And obviously, insects are fantastic at doing this. Just our robots, not so much. That's what makes it hard. So that's what this environmental factors means. So let's move on. While still not available in the market, a number of prototype flapping wing MAVs have been created by research groups. The majority of these small robotic flyers have wing and body shapes that are similar to those found in nature. These are called biological flyers, and they have many desirable traits that would be beneficial for MAVs, as you can expect. Like Mother Nature has already done the work for us, so we should kind of look to what has been done there to get some inspiration. It'll be very easy for us instead of trying to reinvent the wheel. So they say that there are a variety of computational techniques ranging from accurate, time-consuming Navier-Stokes equations to simplified but fast quasi-steady models. So this is where they're trying to determine how to simulate flapping wing flight. Quasi-steady models have long been used since they allow for simple algebraic equations to express the aerodynamic forces. So what this means is they're very simple equations to solve. You can solve them directly. You don't have to do iterative processes like you have to do in CFD. So that makes them very quick. They say the computational efficiency allows for the model to be used for quickly checking the effects of changing key design parameters, such as flapping and pitching amplitude, pitching duration, pitch axis, and wing geometries. So all these things you can change on your MAB to change the flow physics, the lift being produced and the drag being produced, which we'll look at in a second. This is particularly important for MAVs because their small size and operating speeds, lift and thrust need to be produced with moving wings. And this is something to do with all flapping flight. They're with birds, for example, in podcast number 6, when I talk about bird flow physics. And here, wings are doing all the work. It's not like airplanes where we have our wings producing the lift, but our jets or our turbofans producing the thrust. Wings have to do it all. So the quasi-steady model ignores the effects of the flow history and instead considers the forces generated only by the instantaneous orientation and velocity of the wing. The only time dependence comes from the kinematics of the airfoil and not from the fluid flow. Since flow history is not taken into account, not all unsteady mechanisms such as wing wake interactions are captured. Ellington found that the steady state model was insufficient based on the data available at the time. So Sain and Dickinson created a revised quasi-steady model that showed good estimates for measured forces based on empirically determined coefficients of lift and drag. Variants of this model are widely used for studying the flight dynamics of flapping wings due to its simplicity. So let's talk about all this. What they're saying is, for a long time, quasi-steady models, which have been based on either just simple theoretical equations or empirical data, have been used to give a good est give an estimate of how a flapping wing is moving the flow or creating lift and drag. Some are better than others. Now let's talk about this empirically determined quasi-steady model. What does that mean? So empirically determined means effectively you have some sort of database of information, whether that's achieved through experimental or real life situations, or even CFD if you want. If you want to make a simplistic model of that, whatever you want, you just have a bunch of data. Then you make an equation or a bunch of equations that model this data. So, for example, let's say for a wing, if you want to have a certain size wing, you want it to be pitched at a certain angle, you want it to be flapping at a certain rate, you then look at your database and then you do an interpolation effectively, or you use your equation to tell you what the resulting lift will be based on other data you have. So it's an interpolation or extrapolation. Now that's effectively tantamount to a educated guess because empirical equations are usually not that good. If it's for a very well understood phenomenon, such as regular lift being produced by fixed wing aircraft, that's fine. But for flapping wings, which we still don't really understand properly, it's not as good because a lot of the data that we get comes from robots that we do have, which have been built on flawed premises of flapping wings anyway. So it's a erroneous situation all around. And we'll get to actually one point below how our erroneous robots function. So let's move on. The question then arises when a quasi-steady model can give an accurate approximation for the aerodynamic forces and moments on low Reynolds number flyers. The quasi-steady model that they've recently used, like the best one that people are using, is low fidelity but suitable for initial results. So if you want to just get a general idea as to what your MAV is going to be doing, using this model is decent. So the objective of this study now is to assess whether the quasi-steady model differs the most from the Navier-Stokes solution, so like a typical CFD, RANS, URANS, DES, LES, DNS situation, by comparing the results of aerodynamic lift, drag, and moments compared to the quasi-steady results. They say that we use the cycle averaged coefficients to quantify the accuracy of the quasi-steady model. Furthermore, the angle attack in the flapping wing aerodynamics plays a critical role in lift generation, as you can imagine. Hence, we primarily consider the effects of the pitching motion described by the pitching axis location, pitching amplitude, and the pitch duration on the resulting flapping wing aerodynamics. So let's talk about these three parameters here. They considered the pitching axis location. So imagine you have a wing. How does it rotate? Like to give you the angle of attack, where does it rotate about? So typically the wing, if you imagine, let's say like a B wing or a fly wing or whatever, and then the line will be horizontal somewhere, whether that's ranging from the leading edge all the way down to the trailing edge. So somewhere in the middle or these two extremes. So that's where the pitching axis location is located. That's what it refers to. The pitching amplitude indicates how much the wing is pitched. And then the pitch duration is how long it takes to pitch. And that's also related to the flapping motion as well. So those are those three parameters. So here they say we consider hovering flight for rigid wings. And this is an important point. Remember how I mentioned earlier that our MAVs, currently our robots, they're not great replications of real life insects. This is one reason. Our MAVs are typically, they typically have rigid wings. And that's not how wings of insects and even birds to some extent operate. Insects, for example, a butterfly, they can actually bend their wings slightly. And what that does is it allows the wing to make the best use of the resulting flow physics that it generates. So, for example, the butterfly, when it flaps its wings, when it comes up to the top, it's called a clap and fling motion. So the wings, they hit together or go very close together. That forces all the air out. Then as they peel away, the wings are actually bent down a little bit. And as they peel, all the air rushes back in and you get leading edge vortices. And because these wings are bent a little bit, more of the wing is exposed to this leading edge vortex, which then allows it to produce more lift. So this flexibility in the wings allows the butterfly to produce more lift. And so here, and this is not the only insect that does that, but here they say that we consider hovering flight for rigid wings. So I don't know, actually, as I mentioned, we don't really understand insect flight that well. But as far as I'm aware, no insect has rigid wings. They can all flex them a little bit. So that's one limitation. In this study, the Reynolds number is kept constant at a Reynolds number of 100, which is very small, and that's relevant to a fruit fly flight. Alternatively, if I've mentioned in a few other podcasts, dragonflies, they fly at like 50,000 Reynolds numbers. So if you think like a fruit fly is only 100 compared to a dragonfly of 50,000, that's pretty amazing. And also, if you look it up, dragonflies can fly much faster, like 10 times the speed of a fruit fly, which is why they can hunt them and hunt other insects. They're amazing flyers. For hovering flight for insects, there are two primary kinematics, flapping and pitching. So the flapping is obviously the wings moving back and forth, and the pitching is how the wings rotated as it's flapping back and forth. And then they have a pretty cool picture here. And the reason why I wanted to show this picture is, first of all, it shows the wing. So I mentioned earlier the axis location, where the rotation axis, whether that's at the leading edge, the trailing edge, or somewhere in the middle. And also, they have the design space. And the reason why I think the design space is good just to look at, for those of you who've seen the video, for those of you listening, if you want to see the video, you can look on our YouTube channel, or you can just download this paper. It's open access. The link is in the description. And this design space shows you the three different parameters that they're looking at, from the time that the wing is flapping to the angle of attack of the wing, to the location of the rotation axis. And there are all these little dots that show the design space, like a cube with all these dots in there. So they're figuring out how the wing is performing at all these different parameter variations. Then from here, once you get this data, you can then produce an empirical equation. So you can then use this data to have this database, and you say, okay, I now have a wing which doesn't fit any of these points, but it's somewhere between. So then I can interpolate and say, okay, well, I'm going to assume that now this is going to be about this much based on these two other data points, or these other four or six data points, whatever you want to use. So that's how the design space works, in not only in experiments, but when you want to use it later. Okay, so they say we vary three pitching parameters to compare the performance of the quasi-steady model and the Navier-Stokes equation solvers. The three independent variables are the pitching amplitude, so amplitudes of 30 degrees, 45, and 60 degrees, so effectively the angle of attack. The location of the pitching axis measured from the leading edge, normalized by the chord. So zero means that it's pitching right about the leading edge. One means it's pitching right about the trailing edge. So if you have a point about the leading edge that is rotating, it means that the trailing edge is the one that's sweeping in and out. If it's rotating about the trailing edge, it means that the leading edge is the thing that's sweeping in and out, and the rest of the wing as well, but the leading edge is the most swept point, if you can imagine that. And then finally, they look at the duration of the pitch from 0.2, 0.3, and 0.5. This is normalized to the entire flap. So if you have a pitch duration of 0.5, it means the entire flap back or forward, the rotation of the wing is occurring during that entire time. So it hasn't rotated and then flapped. It's rotating as it flaps. So if it's 0.5, it means it takes the entire sweep back motion for it to rotate completely, and then so forth. If it's 0.2, it means it only takes up 40% of that time. They say the study focuses on the pitching kinematics because the angle of attack has been shown to greatly affect the aerodynamic performance. And they looked at just the typical aerodynamic stuff, you know, how you can normalize the, or you can non-dimensionalize the lift drag and moments to get the coefficients. They say here the rotational force is developed by the wing's rotation imparting additional circulation to the flow, which can enhance lift. So there's quite a lot in this short sentence. First of all, the circulation, I'm not going to go into too much. Podcast number 53, I went into a little bit. Just effectively, the circulation is related to the lift. You can calculate the lift based on the circulation. And the circulation in a physical sort of interpretation is really just how much the wing is, or anybody is, affecting the flow. And what they're saying here is that there is additional circulation, which is enhances lift, which is, like, we understand that. That's holds true based on our mathematical equations that we have. But the rotational force is developed by the wing's rotation imparting additional circulation. So the wing rotating imparts more momentum or more force on the air in a rotational manner, and that increases the circulation. So you not only have the linear or the translational motion of the wing, but also the rotational motion. And those two different motions have their own impacts on the flow, and they produce lift and drag and other forces by themselves as well. And I'm sure that there's also a synergistic effect. Synergistic effect, for those who are familiar with that term, it's when the sum of the parts make up for an even better result. So if you have, they work together to make an even better result, what that means. So they say these equations solved, so the Navier-Stokes equations, they're going to look at compared to the quasi-steady. They say they're doing it in a finite volume pressure-based incompressible Navier-Stokes equation solver to simulate the flapping wing. Now, they don't give you too many details about the CFD, but one really good trick, once you understand meshes of CFD, you can look at a mesh and get a good idea as to what the CFD is about. So in this picture, figure two, they have the fruit fly wing corresponding mesh that they produced for their CFD. Now, from this mesh, you can get a good idea as to whether they're using anything from RANS to DNS. So by looking at this mesh, I can immediately tell that it's not DNS because the grid is just too coarse. To do DNS, which is direct numerical simulation, that's the best point. And it takes so much computational power just to do like a simple cylinder and a flow and a low speed flow at that. You need to have a very fine mesh. And that's because you're resolving all the vorticity and all the turbulence and et cetera. It's very computationally expensive. This mesh is not nearly coarse enough. Now, even still, I don't think it's LES. LES is large eddy simulation, which is the second best approach for Navier-Stokes approaches. And that's because the mesh is too coarse again. And then even still, DNS, it probably isn't DNS either because it could be, but I doubt it because, again, the mesh is fairly coarse. I think it's probably URANS, so unsteady Reynolds average Navier-Stokes. And what that means is that the equations would be greatly simplified and it's unsteady, which is good because you obviously have unsteady phenomena, but it isn't nearly as accurate as most of the other Navier-Stokes approaches. So that's one tip. You can look at a mesh and get a good idea as to what the fidelity of the model is, what the accuracy of the model is, in other words. And here they give you a count. They say that they use 7 million cells. That's not that much. So I'm quite certain it's not DNS either, which is the third best below LES. Now, what's cool is they in figure four, they have the Navier-Stokes solutions and they have all these design spaces. So they have three different graphs here and they show you the on graph one they have the angle attack on one axis and the time it takes to rotate on the other axis, and then they've colored this with the lift being produced, the CL, and this is for when the wing is rotating about the leading edge. And interestingly, what this shows is to get the most lift you want to have the smallest rotation time and the highest angle attack, so it has to be a very aggressive, in other words, when it is rotating about the leading edge. This contrasts with the opposite, where if you're rotating about the trailing edge, the higher the rotation and the quicker you rotate, the less lift you're producing. You're actually producing negative lift, so negative 0.5 compared to 1.5. So the maximum, let's say if you rotate the wing at 60 degrees and it only takes 0.40% of the time to rotate when you're rotating around the leading edge, you get a lift coefficient of 1.5. If you're rotating about the trailing edge and you have an angle attack of 60 degrees, and again, it only takes 40% of the time sweeping back to rotate, it's minus 0.5. So the exact opposite trend. And then if you're rotating about the midsection, it's pretty much just constant. Like it really doesn't matter too much what angle attack you have and how long it takes to rotate. You're between 0.45 and 0.6 in the lift coefficient. So that's pretty cool. It shows how different the flow physics becomes based on the resulting lift coefficient, depending on where you rotate the wing and how quickly you rotate it. They say the global trends in this figure suggest that the extreme pitching kinematics, i.e., the motion where the pitching amplitude is largest, above 45 degrees, the duration is short, so less than 60% of the time it takes to sweep back or forward, and the pitching axis is at the leading or trailing edge, have the most effect on the lift coefficient. So, in other words, the more extreme the wing motion, the more extreme the effects on the lift coefficient, which makes sense. Then I have another figure which has it shows you the lift, among other things, the lift being produced with time. So sweeping back and forward for the different angles of attack and for different times it takes to rotate the wing. So from 60% of the time to 40% of the time. And interestingly, it shows that if you're pitching around the middle of the wing and you're pitching at about 60% of the time, so about a mild pitching rate, the lift coefficient is pretty much always positive, regardless of whether you're moving forward or backwards. And if you rotate the wing more, it actually drops a little bit. So the best lift is being produced when you have only 30 degrees pitching compared to 60 degrees. Now, if you were to rotate the wing about the trailing edge, the lift just goes terrible. Like literally, it's there, most of the time that it's sweeping, it's not producing any lift at all. So what this means is pitching about the trailing edge of a flapping wing is not how insects do it. I mean, if they do it, they have some other mechanism to produce lift, because looking at this graph, there's no way it can produce any positive lift from doing this. And likewise, the drag is similarly chaotic. So what I can sort of conclude from this is that insects are probably pitching their wings anywhere between the midspan to the leading edge in that region there, it looks like. And what they have is cool here, the ISO surfaces of the Q criterion to provide a visual indication of the vortical structures in the flow field. So a few things that I want to describe here. First of all, they're plotting the different angles of attack that the wing is pitched at, from 30 degrees to 60 degrees. And interestingly, the higher the pitch angle, the smaller the vortical structures are. So at 30 degrees, there are a lot of vortical structures and they're very big. And as you increase angle attack to 60, they become very small. And that's interesting because I thought perhaps it might be the other way around, because you'd imagine, like, if you have 60 degree angle attack, you're moving a lot more of the floor and it's very aggressive, but then it may be a stall pattern. And also we have to remember that the wing is not flexing, it's rigid, so that may also affect the flow physics that we're getting compared to insects. So that's something to be mindful of. But they say large vertical structures are produced when the wing is pitching at a lower amplitude, so amplitude of 30 degrees. Since the angle of attack is the highest during the mild stroke. When the pitching amplitude is 60 degrees, the vertical structures are relatively small. So that's where I'm going to end this podcast. I'm going to pick it up in podcast number two because it's getting a bit long already. And I'll see you there. But make sure to check out the Atmosphere Hawk if you want to make your experiments better. It actually measures the density of your air so you can get rid of that error in your experiments and also helps validate your CFD. Link in the description. Peace out, amigos.